I love the story of an underdog. Whether it's the miracle on ice when the USA hockey team beat the Soviets in the 1980 Olympics, or when Buster Douglas knocked out Iron Mike Tyson, or when the British boy was taking on Father Christmas. We all love the story of the underdog. Young person, God divinely placed you at this hour in human history. You and God do make a majority, and it's the quintessential simple majority. There will be times in your life where you may think that the battles that you face are seemingly unwinnable. And with the events of this past year, you may even feel that way right now. But God is God. He is never the underdog, and with Him, you have a rendezvous with destiny. In 1776, Thomas Paine wrote the infamous words, "These are the times that try men's souls. The summer soldier and the sunshine patriot will, in this crisis, shrink from service to their country. But he that stands by it now deserves the love and thanks of man and woman." It was a dark time in our history there at the beginning of the Revolutionary War. But I want you to come with me to another time in history, about another exceptional nation, the nation of Israel. These too were dark times. Saul, the nation's king, had pursued his own way and chose willful disobedience. They had walked down a path that would cause great harm, and additionally, the Spirit of God had departed from Saul. The consequences of that are immeasurable. Due to God's righteous judgment, the Philistines were posing an increasing threat to Israel's security. God's command to Exodus could not have been more clear. When He said to the children of Israel, "Thou shalt drive them out before thee, thou shalt make no covenant with them, they shall not dwell in the land." But history says that they failed to obey God. And so, we find ourselves in a valley called Elah. It was here that the armies of Israel and the Philistines had lined up facing each other on two opposing mountains. Israel's posture was more defensive. Trembling, she cowered on the oppressive shadow of the Philistine forces. On one side of one mountain was Goliath. And according to the biblical record, Goliath was near 10 feet tall. The staff of his spear was 12 feet 7 inches long in order to hold a spear's head that weighed nearly 20 pounds. Goliath was tested and had already achieved greatness. And every day, twice a day, for 40 days, he challenged the Hebrews. He was daring Israel to send someone to beat him in combat. And upon the result of that solitary man-to-man combat conflict, the freedoms of these two respective nations rested. Morning and night, Goliath taunted them. Now, I don't like hearing bad news before I go to bed at night. I certainly don't like thinking about the loss of my potential freedoms and my children being fatherless or my country's demise when I lay me down to sleep. Those thoughts do not lead to sweet dreams and restful slumber. So Goliath knew what he was doing. He was wearing them down. The Bible puts it rather bluntly. They were dismayed and they were greatly afraid. They had forgot the command that God had given Joshua that said, "Don't be afraid or dismayed, but be strong and of good courage, because your Lord is with you wherever you go." Perhaps they felt like God would never meet them in this valley of Elah. And then there's David. Jesse had three older sons that were serving in the army. David, of course, we know, he was tending the flock of sheep. And one day Jesse was sent, he sent David to the battle site with some granola and some gluten-free bread and some non-dairy cheese. I'm from Colorado, that's how we roll it out there. David walked half the day's trip and he arrived in the afternoon, and David made his way to find his brothers, and he found them. And as at that time, Goliath appeared and he started into one of his blasphemous tirades against the Israelite forces. And verse 24 of 1 Samuel 17 says this, that Goliath showed up and everyone, not a few, But everyone fled, and they were sore afraid. So David was rightly confused. How could this be allowed to go on? Could this Philistine continue to defy God and nothing be done? If allowed to continue, this would not end well. So David was my kind of guy, though. He's bold enough to charge hell with a water pistol. And he asks, what's the price for killing this guy? Well, that didn't go over too well. His brother said, you need to go back home and watch the sheep. And this is what makes me really love David. It's at this moment that David's lips give rise to one of the most thrilling inquiries of all of Scripture. So with a note of exasperation, he asks, is there not a cause? In other words, is there never a time to take a stand? Is there not a truth that's worth living for? And indeed, is there not one worth dying for if necessary? His noble heart pulsed with divine patriotism, and so David volunteered to fight the evil giant. David was an ordinary person from an ordinary place, from an ordinary family with ordinary resources, and God called him. And he calls us to a rendezvous with destiny. I want to look at this one story of David. And I want us to learn that how some of the most unsuspecting people, God, they can step into their destiny and God can use them to change the course of an entire nation. Look with me up on the screen as we read from 1 Samuel 17. It says, when the words were heard that David spake, he said, is there not a cause? When those words were heard, they rehearsed them before Saul, and he sent for him. And David said to Saul, let no man's heart fail him. Thy servant will go and fight this Philistine. That's Hebrew for, here, hold my root beer. Some of you all get that a little later. And Saul said to David, you're not able to go against this Philistine to fight him, for thou art but a youth, and he's been a man of war since his youth. And David said to Saul, thy servant kept his father's sheep. And there came a lion, and there came a bear, and took the lamb out of the flock, and I went out after him and smote him and delivered him out of his mouth. And when he arose against me, I caught him by his beard and I punched his beard off and smote him and slew him. And the servant slew both the lion and the bear. And this uncircumcised Philistine will be as one of them, seeing he hath defied the armies of the living God. David said, moreover, the Lord that delivered me out of the paw of the lion and out of the paw of the bear, he will deliver me out of the hand of this Philistine. And Saul said to David, go, Lord be with thee. And he took his staff and he took 5 stones and he put them in the shepherd's bag and he took a sling in his hand and he drew near the Philistine. And the Philistine came on and drew unto David, and the man that bare his shield went before him. I want you to hear this. First of all, God's people of destiny always have a relationship with God that is based on trust and obedience. God's people of destiny always have a relationship with God that is based on trust and obedience. You see, David had a history of being undersized. He had been watching the sheep. He had to go up against a lion. He had to go up against a bear. And because of that history and God's provision for him at that time, he knew that he could go against Goliath. Now, I have a picture here. I think you can see it of Kevin Hart. So Kevin Hart's 5'4", and there's Shaquille O'Neal, who's about 7'2", and then you have Yao Ming, who's about 7'7". Now, if you really want a correlation of David and Goliath, add a foot to Kevin Hart. Let's put David at about 6'4". But then we're going to have to add 2 feet to Yao Ming, and that's what he was going up against. In this next slide, you'll see a picture of my son's hand next to Odell Beckham Jr.'s hand. They work out together, if you can believe that. And so my son, who's 5'11", and Odell Beckham's, who gets paid millions of dollars to catch football, is an all-pro wide receiver for the Cleveland Browns. Thank you, Cleveland Brown fans, if you're any of you are out there. Yeah. Some of the heartiest fans in the world are Cleveland Browns fans. Imagine adding 4 feet to Odell Beckham Jr., the size of the hand that could make a fist, that could put the hand on your head and break your neck just with a twist. David had a history of being undersized. David also had a history of, and right now he was presently out-armored, outnumbered, and out-weaponed. It was 2-1. Goliath even had a shield bearer. But here's the thing that David had, because he had a deep abiding relationship with God, is that David could out trash talk Goliath. And you say, why would a man of God do that? Let me tell you why. What David's trash talking shows us, there's two very important things that I want you to be aware of. First, it shows that David has humility. See, Paul, how in the world could a guy who's seemingly humble be trash talking? It's because the definition of humility is not thinking lowly of yourself. Humility is having a proper understanding of who you are and having a proper understanding of who God is. And David did have that. So David could say to Saul, "He will deliver me. God will deliver me." And he could later say to Goliath, "This is how it's going to go down." In the same way that Inigo Montoya said, "Hey, my name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die." This is basically what David said. David beat Inigo Montoya to the line. David said, "This is how it's going to go down. The Lord will deliver you into my hand. I will kill you. I will cut your head off. And I'm going to give your body and the rest of the Philistines' bodies to the vultures." That's how it's going to happen. That's trash talk. David could do that because he had a relationship with God. And here's the biggest thing beyond that. David had a relationship with God that was so dear that he could recognize his voice when God spoke to him. This wasn't a case of, "Hey, it's one-on-one, we're playing basketball, I'm going to beat you. And if I lose, oh well, I'll get you next time." The stakes were a tad higher than that. Number one, you'll die. Number two, the entire nation loses its freedom. So David had to have heard from God. If he's going to say to the king, "This is how it's going to go down," and if he's going to say to Goliath, "I'm going to kill you and cut off your head," he couldn't have just gone on his gut. He had to have heard from God. People of destiny have that kind of relationship with God. Is your student, listen to this, is your relationship with God so deep that you can recognize his voice when he's speaking to you? Spend time with him, because you'll recognize it when you need to. And if his voice comes to you and says to do something, do you trust him enough to obey it, no matter what the cost? Secondly, I want us to go back to the passage in 1 Samuel 17. It says, "When the Philistines looked about and saw David, he disdained him. Too young, ruddy, and of fair countenance." Hey, are you sending me Matthew McConaughey? What is this? Some pretty boy that's coming to fight me? And the Philistine says, "Am I a dog that you come to me with sticks?" The Philistine cursed David by his gods. And the Philistine said to David, "Come to me. I'll give you flesh to the fowls of the air and the beasts of the field." And this is where, this is where the trash talk with David begins. He says, "You come to me with a sword and a spear and with a shield. Me? I come to you in the name of the Lord God of hosts, the armies of Israel, whom you've defied. This day," this is how it's going to go down, "the Lord will deliver you into my hand. I will smite thee. I'll take thine head from thee. I will give the carcasses of the hosts of the Philistines, not just yours, but all these other guys behind you, I'm going to give them to the fowls of the air and to the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. And all of this assembly shall know that the Lord saveth not with the sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands." And it came to pass when the Philistine arose. Now, here's that. I find that little phrase a little interesting. Had he sat down to kind of have some popcorn, maybe have like a peanut butter and jelly sandwich to listen to what David was saying? And so now he's making his grand entrance. He's standing himself. He's intimidating David. He stands up and he drew nigh to meet David. But David hastened toward the Philistine. And while he's running toward him, he put his hand in his bag, he takes a stone, and he slang it, and smote the Philistine in the head, and the stone sunk in his forehead, he fell on his face to the earth. So David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and with a stone, and smote the Philistine, and killed him, slew him. But there's no sword in the hand of David. People of destiny, God's people of destiny, have a bias toward action. They don't just talk, they act. They never run from a fight. In fact, they usually run to it. In Africa, in the Serengeti, antelopes hear the sound of a lion's roar. And the lion can roar and it can be heard from 5 to 8 miles. And when the animals hear it, their instinct tells them to run the opposite direction. Doing so, however, means they almost run to their certain death because lions expect their prey to do just that. The male of the pride anticipates where the antelope runs, while the lioness is lion ambush opposite the male. So when the lion roars, the startled antelope run directly into the jaws of the waiting lionesses. When faced with threats to our security, people all too often run away from the roar of their life. God's people of destiny understand that success lies in running to the battle. Always run to the roar. God's people always use weapons that God gives them, and they usually seem unconventional. If I'm David at this time, I'd be like, okay, it's time for God to introduce a weapon of mass destruction. I realize I have a sling, but wouldn't it be nice and wouldn't it be really dramatic if I could get one of these Stinger ground-to-air missile launchers? Keep my distance from old Goliath, or maybe God brings in an Apache helicopter. I get in this really cool way, I use the Gatling gun, everyone's blown away, it's an amazing thing. But that's not how God works. Because you see, with Moses, God used his rod. With Gideon, he used a trumpet. With Samson, he used a jawbone. With Shamgar, he used an ox goad. And with David, he simply had a sling. God does that because he uses unconventional and ordinary weapons in the hands of his ordinary people to get the glory. And finally, God's people are people of action because they live by faith and courage. They get things done. I love the thing that was above one of the doors of our classrooms here that said, "You and God make a majority." I love it when Hebrews 10:38 says this, but it's kind of a haunting verse too. It says, "My righteous ones will live by faith, but I take no pleasure in those who shrink back." How many want to please God? If you want to please God, don't shrink back in fear. And then Revelation 21:8 says this. It's a very haunting verse. It talks about who has their part in the lake of fire. It leads with what people don't do, and it ends with what people do. I find that interesting. We see here that the abominable, the murderers, the whoremongers, the sorcerers, the idolaters, and liars, they all have their part in the lake of fire. But what's interesting, and you don't see the words there, it says, the fearful and the unbelieving. Basically, it's the cowards and those who lack faith. I'm not going to test that one. I'm going to be full of faith, and I'm going to have courage. And I want you to as well. Finally, God's people of destiny always inspire others to be courageous because courage is contagious. And as William Wallace said in the movie Braveheart, people don't follow titles. They follow courage. The Jewish historian Josephus wrote that 30,000 Philistines were killed and 60,000 were wounded in that rout that day. Goliath's head was taken as a trophy to Jerusalem. It was a time of great victory for Israel. But in 2 Samuel 23, we read about a roster of David's mighty men. These men joined David before he had the title of king. They obviously had watched David's heroic courage that day. And Saul was fiercely jealous of David because he became an overnight celebrity. So he had fallen out of favor with this establishment and with the king, and the king was hunting him down. These men joined David in the wilderness and became his loyal supporters. Now, they were a rough group, but later many of them accomplished great things for David, as described there in 2 Samuel 23. Now, why was that genealogy? And are you like me? Sometimes you get to the Bible genealogies and you start drooling and you kind of fall asleep and wake up. Okay? If it's in your devotions and you're reading a genealogy, you just like skip it. Don't skip 2 Samuel 23. These things were written, it says in Romans 15:4, that says, "Everything that was written in the past was written to teach us, so that through endurance and the encouragement of Scriptures, we can have hope." So I read about a guy named Adino who lifted up his spear and killed 800 at one time. Eliezer, who killed so many people by himself as he protected the country of Israel, that it took a while to pry the sword away from his hand. His grip wouldn't let it go. And then there's my favorite, a guy named Benaiah. We'll call him Benny. He slew two lion-like men from Moab. Now, I don't know what makes a person lion-like, but he killed two of them. He also chased down a lion one day. I don't understand why anyone would do that. But he chased down a lion into a pit on a snowy day and killed him. So basically, he went out after the fiercest of animals into the scariest of places in the worst conditions and killed a lion. And one time he was struggling with this Egyptian, and the Egyptian had a spear in his hand, and he went down only with a staff, and he plucked the spear out of the Egyptian's hand and slew him with his own spear. I love reading stories like that. What does that say about me? I like violence. I'm not promoting violence. I'm not promoting any violence. The world's value. I want you to learn this real quick about Benaiah. The world's value system is opposed to biblical values. We must never allow the processes and the lifestyles to infiltrate our thinking and our actions. But that said, it's interesting to notice that Benaiah used the Egyptian's own spear to defeat him. Christians should take every opportunity to fight fire with fire in some ways. We need to learn how to be the best storytellers. Okay? We've abandoned that in Christianity. I want you to do something for me. Those of you who are into this, I want you to download a podcast. See me. If you forget this later, see me. It's called Red Pilled America. Download this podcast. I want the best storytellers at Bob Jones to join me in doing something like this. If you're into that kind of stuff, see me. And I want you to email me at paulisaacs@mac.com. And I'd love to talk with you about this. We need songwriters. We must be good entrepreneurs. We need to be good at marketing. We need to be able to capture data and analyze that data and be software developers. These things have been developed primarily to serve the world system, but let's redeem them and use them for the glory of God. Benaiah didn't hesitate to exchange his outdated club for a more sophisticated spear. Now, since I'm a fighter by nature and since I'm always looking for the next beard to punch off, I'd like to talk with you as I close about where we stand in our culture today. And I don't want to say this, I wish I didn't have to, but I want you to know that we're in a war. We're in a war against spiritual wickedness in high places. But make no mistake about it, this is an epic spiritual battle that has earthly consequences. Whether you want to admit it or not, or you want to deny it, it doesn't change it. We're waging a war and we have a real enemy. The enemy hates you. He hates your future wife. He hates your future husband. He hates your future children. He hates your church. He hates your country. And he hates your God. And God says that we have this enemy, and this enemy is the devil. And then he tells us this: to be sober, to be vigilant, because your adversary prowleth around like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. So I want to ask you this: what does it mean to be sober and vigilant? What does it mean to be strong and of good courage? Well, I can't say what it means for you specifically, but you need to ask God to tell you. And we best figure it out and figure it out soon. Now, I believe revival is coming, and I believe we're going to have a cleansing in the church. I believe that there's not going to be any room for compromise, but many will, and many already have. But I also believe that the same God that said it thousands of years ago means it today when he said, "If my people, who are called by my name, will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and I will forgive their sins and I'll heal their land." So what are the issues that we face today? And please hear me. I love these violent stories, but I'm not calling for violence. I'm imploring us to stand for truth, to speak it in love, yet speak it with boldness. These issues, the issues of freedom of speech and censorship and the cancel culture that's happening, the issues of marriage and family and gender and God's design for sex. Got everybody's attention real quick, by the way. Said that word. I'll never have anybody, never lose any crowd of young people if I talk about three things. Sex, the end times, and will there be sex in the end times? I may never be asked to speak here again. The issue of religious freedom. The issue of human trafficking that is going on at an alarming. It's so egregious. The issue of election integrity. And if we do not have election integrity, folks, we do not have America. And you all know how I feel about the issue of the sanctity of life. I believe we are at a crossroads in the United States, and we have three lessons we can learn from this Valley of Elah. First, this is no time for spiritual weakness. No time. Proverbs 14:34 says, righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. You need to live a life of personal holiness. You need to seek the morality and good policy in your local community. And you need to pray for our country. Now, I have a slide that talks about how you can get involved. I want you to text this number if you can. Take down this number and text it. If you want to get connected and pray for our country, to think biblically about issues and make sure to vote in every election, even the small ones, yes. Text the word TOGETHER to 40649. We at My Faith Folks will get in contact with you. Also, I remember my email, paulisaacs@mac.com. But this is no time for weakness. This is a time, though, for boldness to speak the truth, to speak it with love, and to speak it without compromise. And this, remember, everyone here, no matter what your vocation is, has a role to play in this. Don't wait for the cavalry to come. The cavalry ain't coming. You are the cavalry. We must step into the arena. We all must engage in some capacity. The dishes are dirty and they're piling up, so we got to roll up our sleeves and get cleaning. Now, it could come at a cost, though. But I always like to ask this question. What's the worst that could happen? I die. And though you be done to the death, what then? If you've battled the best you could. If you've played your part in the world of men, why, the critic will call it good. Death comes with a crawl, or it comes with a pounce. And whether he's slow or spry, it isn't the fact that you're dead that counts, but only how did you die. Ronald Reagan, in his speech, A Time for Choosing, back in 1964, said this: if nothing in this world is worth dying for, when did this begin? Should Moses have told the children of Israel to live under the slavery of pharaohs? Should the patriots at the Concord Bridge have thrown down their guns and refused to fire the shot heard round the world? The martyrs of history were not fools, and our honored dead who gave their lives to stop the advance of the Nazis didn't die in vain. Winston Churchill said this: there's something going on beyond time and space that spells, whether we like it or not, it spells duty. You and I have a rendezvous with destiny. I close with this. On December 24th, 1776, a beleaguered general, George Washington, was looking for some way to inspire his Continental troops after suffering crushing defeats in New York. His undermanned army was facing the British Army, now strengthened by German mercenaries under the command of General William Howe, encamped across the Delaware River in Trenton, New Jersey. It was cold and snowy. His troops lacked provision, and many of them were about to leave the army on December 31st, just a week later. It was Christmas time, and the last thing they wanted to do was embark on a secret attack across an icy river in the dead of the night on Christmas Eve. General Washington found the inspiration needed to rouse his troops in the writings of The American Crisis, a pamphlet that was just published 5 days earlier. And he ordered the 3,400 words to be read aloud at McConkie's Ferry to his troops. And I just want to share a short portion of that with you today as I close. These are the times that try men's souls. The summer soldier and the sunshine patriot will, in this crisis, shrink from service to their country. But he who stands by it now deserves the love and thanks of men and women. Tyranny, like hell, is not easily conquered. Yet we have this consolation with us that the harder the conflict, the more glorious the triumph. What we obtain too cheap, we esteem too lightly. It is dearness only that gives everything its value. Britain, with an army to enforce her tyranny, has declared that she has the right not only to tax, but to bind us in all cases whatsoever. And if being so bound in that manner is not slavery, then there is no such thing as slavery upon this earth. For so unlimited a power can only belong to God. In the 14th century, the whole English army, after ravaging the kingdom of France, was driven back by men petrified with fear. And this brave exploit was performed by a few broken forces, collected and headed by a woman, Joan of Arc. Would that heaven might inspire some Jersey maid to spirit up her countrymen and save her. I thank God that I fear not. I see no cause for fear. That Christmas Eve night, after adopting the motto "Victory or Death," the newly inspired troops crossed the Delaware River and attacked a sleeping garrison at Trenton on Christmas Day to provide the first victory in the Revolutionary Army. And we know how that ended. Young people, you and I have a rendezvous with destiny. Let's change the world together. David fought for his country's freedom, and I believe that we will be called on to do the same, not with slings and swords. This is a spiritual battle, so we must be wise as serpents and harmless as doves. So let us have courage. Let us all run to the roar. And as Reagan said, let us preserve for our children this, the last best hope of man on earth, or we'll sentence them to take the last step into 1,000 years of darkness. Let it not be said of us, not on our watch. We may seem like the underdog. We may seem to be outnumbered. But we do have that simple majority. Me, you, and God.